This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The standoff continues in Russia between President Boris Yeltsin and the Congress of People's Deputies. The full Congress meets tomorrow in an emergency session and is expected to consider impeaching Yeltsin. We asked William Taubman for some background that would help us understand what's happening in Russia today. Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's the author of Moscow Spring and is working on a biography of Khrushchev. He's been to Russia 5 times in the past 18 months. We spoke this afternoon right after a speech by Boris Yeltsin and an interview with Ruslan Khasbulatov, chair of the Congress. I asked Taubman if he thought their statements, as broadcast on television, indicated any changes in the standoff.
Well, it does change it in one way, in the sense that Khasbulatov did not demand Yeltsin's impeachment. It has been thought that that would be the primary business of the Congress when it meets tomorrow, and if the Congress were to proceed to impeach Yeltsin, that would throw even more fat in the fire. So if Khasbulatov pulled back on that and at the same time called upon Yeltsin to join in a government of national reconciliation, I think that shows that he's a bit, that Khasbulatov is being a little bit more cautious and careful. That doesn't mean he's backing off, and it doesn't mean the crisis is over. On the other hand, Yeltsin was very tough. He didn't even pay any attention to Khasbulatov, ignored him entirely, attacked the Congress. So I think the basic position of the two sides remains the same, but there's a little less tension in the air.
Are we still looking at Congress meeting tomorrow to consider impeaching Yeltsin?
Well, they're going to meet, and I'm sure that if Khasbulatov himself doesn't demand impeachment, there are more extreme forces among the deputies who will demand it. But they've demanded it before, and they've always lost. And the fact that Khasbulatov didn't mention it today, I think, means that he's been counting heads and decided that if he were to push for impeachment, he would lose.
You think the odds of Congress impeaching Yeltsin tomorrow are slim?
Yes, I do.
The largest coal mining union has threatened to strike if Boris Yeltsin is impeached. How much popular support do you think Boris Yeltsin has now, and how much support do you think the Congress has?
One of the effects, I think, of the crisis is to increase Yeltsin's support. A lot of people had become increasingly disenchanted with him, both in the Congress itself and in the populace. After all, at one point, he had a majority of the Congress with him. And in December, when in the last meeting of the Congress, when he called upon his supporters among the deputies to walk out of the hall with them, only about 100 out of the 1,300 followed him. Similarly, in the population, he won with 60% of the vote in 1991. And the polls, until this crisis, had him down somewhere in the low 30s or even 20% popular rating, positive rating. From what I've seen since the crisis began, and people have started thinking that it may be a matter of life and death or losing the reforms, his rating has gone up. And in fact, there was a report in today's paper that among Muscovites, some 59% said they would vote for him on April 25th.
The Congress of People's Deputies was elected in 1990 before the end of communism. Are they all former communist hardliners?
No, they are not all hardliners. Most of them are former communists. But on the other hand, most of Yeltsin's advisors and most of his government are former communists too, as is he, of course. So that one of the things that has to be said is that Yeltsin, whatever you like about him, is guilty of demonizing the deputies. To be sure, among those deputies, there are people who are not only former communists, but still communists, and who would like to return to communism. And there are also among those deputies extremist nationalists, fiercely anti-Western, anti-Semitic, anti-democratic. But I think the bulk of the deputies are centrists of one sort or another. Many of them are former allies of Yeltsin's. And what at least some of them want is not an end to reforms, but a slower pace of reform. That doesn't mean that one should suddenly give up on Yeltsin and embrace these centrists, because these same people have allowed themselves to be led by the nose by Khasbulatov. And I think that as between these two sides, Yeltsin on the one hand and the Congress on the other, I at least think that Yeltsin is the better hope. But it's not really fair. It's really all too political on Yeltsin's part to portray this as a battle between the forces of reform led by himself and those who would rebuild the old order.
What is the fight between Congress and Yeltsin really about?
Well, it's about many things. It's about the pace of reform, as I said. On the one hand, Yeltsin's approach has been shock therapy in the economy. It has been a foreign policy which has been ready to agree with the West on almost everything. The Congress would like to move much more slowly in economic reform. The Congress would like to see Russia have a more independent foreign policy. So it's about the issues in part. It's also, however, about personalities, as politics often ends up being, between Yeltsin on the one hand and Khasbulatov on the other. Both very complicated individuals, both, I think, in some ways less attractive beneath the surface than they seem to be on the surface. It's really, though in the largest sense, the confrontation is about how this country manages the transition to democracy from totalitarianism to a free market from a super-centralized planned economy, and how, thirdly, it gives up two empires, really, the former empire in Eastern Europe and then the rest of the Soviet republics. To do all of these three things and to do them rapidly is really an almost impossible task. And as a result, it's not surprising that it's produced these deep divisions, which in turn have produced a kind of paralysis in politics. And the danger of that, in turn, is that the paralysis, or the gridlock, to use an American term, prevents the kind of resolute action that's required to, if they're ever to make it through to democracy, a free market, and to become a democratic nation.
So this is a terrible paradox for Russia. Just as it really needs to move decisively, it's being paralyzed.
Yes, that's my position, but I should say that there is another somewhat paradoxical position, which some of my friends, Russian friends, have mentioned to me, and that is that this stalemate is not necessarily a bad thing as long as the process of, say, privatization is allowed to proceed. That is, in some ways, the politicians can make trouble if they're not paralyzed, and so Russia may be better off, so goes this argument, if the politicians are at each other's throats rather than messing up the transition in society as a whole. The reason I don't accept this is that it seems to me that the paralysis not only prevents them from, let us say, giving land to peasants, which they still haven't managed to do, or coping with demands for autonomy on the part of non-Russian ethnic regions, but the paralysis and the fight among the politicians also discredits the very institutions that they've got to build if they're going to make a go of democracy. The specter of these people hewing and hacking at each other tends to discredit the notion of a parliament, the multiplicity of parties, their constant battle with each other, the rhetoric they use discredits the notion of parties. The way the Constitutional Court functioned in the last 2 days, ruling on Yeltsin's decree before they'd even read it, tends to discredit the notion of a constitutional court. All of these are very bad omens for the future.
Well, I wonder if you think that the legacy of Russia's authoritarian communist style is affecting the way this confrontation is being played out now.
Well, that legacy is alive and kicking, and all you have to do is read their speeches or watch them on television. The legacy is one in which compromise is a dirty word, in which coalition building is something that they don't know how to do, and in which you refer to your opponents, your political opponents, not as not with senatorial courtesy American style, but as riffraff, as madmen. This is standard discourse.
Well, Khasbulatov accused Yeltsin of being pathological and having a genetic link to Bolshevism.
Yes, and Yeltsin has given back as good as he's gotten. Actually, today, one thing I noticed was that Khasbulatov was on his best behavior and was trying to appeal to his deputies as well as to the population. He was really very clever about it, too. I noticed that in the course of a minute and a half, he managed to appeal to Russians by saying that the Russian Federation has to be kept together, and then appeal to the non-Russian regions of Russia, and even some of the Russian regions that would like to get a little more distance from the center by saying that they would be endangered by the strong presidency that Yeltsin was trying to, or the dictatorial presidency that Yeltsin was trying to build.
Khasbulatov, the head of Congress, is a new name to a lot of Americans. Would you tell us something about his background to help us put him in context?
Well, the first thing to say about him in a context like the Russian one, where ethnicity looms large, is that he's not Russian. He's from Chechnya. He's a Chechen. That's an area in the northern Caucasus, the southern part of Russia, which is, of all the non-Russian ethnic regions of the Federation, one of the most militant about obtaining its independence. That is, I think, related to the fact that Khasbulatov, in some ways, is more Russian than the Russian president. That is, he has cast his lot with Russia rather than with his home area. That also explains why that's one reason why he is so unpopular among Russians. There is, I'm afraid to say, a kind of rampant racism that you find in Moscow. And one of the things you hear is that a lot of the troubles, a lot of the high prices, a lot of the crime is the result, Russians will tell you, of these Caucasians, and the Chechens prime among them. So when Khasbulatov bids for power, he's held back by that. He's also an economist, and he made much of that today in his speech. He said he's a professional economist who knows all about a market economy, and he knows that Yeltsin's not building it in the right way. Some of the other economists would probably claim that Khasbulatov isn't much of one. He's also, if you watch him on television, as I do, he is very slick. I would even use the word unctuous. He appears to be modesty personified, but there are very credible reports that he has moved into a former residence of Leonid Brezhnev. It's also been said that he's been found on the floor of his office suffering from mysterious maladies. It's also been said that he suffers from some kind of fear of unfounded fear of persecution. Here I am, I'm afraid, repeating the kinds of things that Russian politicians say about each other. But as I said, that's part of the discourse.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Taubman, professor of political science at Amherst College and author of the book Moscow Spring. He's writing a forthcoming biography of Khrushchev. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Russian scholar William Taubman is my guest, and we're talking about what's happening now in Russia. Part of what we're seeing now really is a fight between the legislative and executive branches in Russia, and, you know, a fight over how the Constitution should read. What has the process been since the end of communism of working out the balance of power in Russia?
Well, the Constitution itself is an old document adopted under the Soviet rule. It's had, somewhere I read, it's been amended 320 times since then. And the amendments themselves have become a weapon in the battle, still being used even as we speak. It would certainly be a good idea for that constitution to be replaced by a new one, and that's one of the things that all sides have said they want to do. But until recently, they've been unable to agree on what kind of constitution they wanted to replace it with, and they've been unable to agree on just how to replace it anyway. So constitution making has itself been a form of political struggle, but of course the political struggle goes on in other ways as well, both in the parliament and out. The media has been another arena. Yeltsin has been very careful to hold on to the media and the parliament. Just today on the Russian news, I heard them say that they decided to create their own television, but they didn't allocate enough money to do it. An example of the way the media is used is that the other day, the very day that the crisis was heating up, the day that Yeltsin's mother was being buried, the funeral was taking place, the television on the main television channel showed the funeral. And it was a beautiful piece of television. The camera faded in and out, showing a portrait of his mother, showing Yeltsin himself in tears, showing the flowers around the coffin. And the symbolism, which I'm sure was not entirely unintended, was that here was Mother Russia, who had died, and here was her son remaining to do battle on her behalf. And it was a very touching piece, as well as one with a political punch. And that's another example of how the struggle is carried on.
Do you think Yeltsin's made any big mistakes that are in part responsible for the crisis he's facing now?
Yes, I do. I think that Yeltsin, well, first of all, he's done a number of things right, and we could talk about those if you like, but he's also made some mistakes. Politically speaking, he really missed a chance at the time when he was most popular in the fall of 1991 and to build himself a political base. He has several times talked about the need to set up a political party, but it never seems to happen. And furthermore, he's proved himself either unwilling or unable to lobby Congress in the way that a president should. He just doesn't seem to think it's worth his time, or maybe he thinks it's beneath him. And furthermore, his tactics have been questionable. He seems to be, if it's possible, both indecisive and precipitous, impulsive at the same time. That is, he takes too long to move, and when he moves, he sometimes overdoes it. When I was in Moscow in last January, 2 months ago, I sat around with some of his supporters, and they gave me a blow-by-blow account of the December session of the Congress, and they pointed out that he had changed his position five different times, sometimes in the case of a couple of hours, lurching back and forth between confrontation with his foes and accommodation. And although there might have been a rationale for it, it had left many of his own supporters dissatisfied.
Do you think that a lot of people who are supporting Yeltsin wish that Yeltsin was more worthy of that support?
In Russia, you mean?
Well, in Russia and also maybe in the Clinton administration.
Well, I suspect that that is the case. I think I can't speak as for the Clinton administration. I don't know the details of their thinking, but I have some sense of how a lot of Russians feel based on my recent trips there and following the press.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them feel that, well, many of them feel a plague on both houses. Those are the people who will not vote at all in the referendum. And many of those who support Yeltsin do so wishing he were more worthy of their support, supporting him in some ways as the lesser of evils, distinctly the lesser of evils. Therefore, there's no doubt in their minds that they should back him, but nonetheless worried about him and his behavior both in the past and in the future.
Well, you've gone through some of Yeltsin's mistakes. What do you think his strengths have been since he became president?
His greatest strength was that he took the plunge, that after 6 years of temporizing under Gorbachev, Yeltsin actually opted to let prices rise as part of a movement toward a freer market. And there is now a market in the former Soviet Union and in Russia. It's crude, it's primitive, it's uncivilized, it's sort of the Wild East. But enterprises do now make their own decisions and no longer rely on central planners, and a process of privatization has begun. So there are achievements to his credit, very important achievements in the area of the economy. Even in the area of politics, he has been, until quite recently, remarkably patient with parties and parliaments and others who disagreed with him. He is a kind of born-again Democrat with some old authoritarian instincts. But so far, he has played by the rules. And a third area in which I think he's been very good is in his handling of relations with the other former Soviet republics, like Ukraine. if Russia ever played Serbia to Ukraine's Croatia, there could be a civil war which would make events in Yugoslavia look like a kindergarten. That's the real danger, perhaps the greatest danger of all, what with nuclear weapons floating around. And Yeltsin has been very statesmanlike in his handling of that issue.
One last question. You are still writing your book on Khrushchev, your biography of Khrushchev. Is all of this changing how Khrushchev looks? Do you go through continuing periods of Khrushchev revisionism?
Actually, my first thought when you mentioned Khrushchev is a little bit different. It's that the conflict that's going on right now is presumably not that different from the sort of conflict that went on in Khrushchev's time, except in those days it went on under the surface, under the carpet. Of course, there were fewer people those days involved in the conflict, maybe just a handful, and the larger society was unaware of it. Nowadays, there are many people involved, and everybody's aware of it. But in that sense, there's a difference. As to Khrushchev himself, I wouldn't say he looks better in the light of all this. He was a man of a different age. He himself attempted to carry out reforms, succeeded only in part. That was, as I say, a different era.
Well, William Taubman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
William Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.